Hey, hello everyone. Welcome to This Week in Mormons. We're here to talk about Mormon issues. I'm going to talk in my Hispanic accent for the entire show.
Jeff, I feel like this is offensive.
I don't know if this is racist or not. Especially now that I'm like...
I don't think that you can talk like that.
I don't know if this is racist, man.
I'm 95% sure that's not okay.
What I'm going to do now is just put on some old Cheech Marin movies.
And you can speak in any sort of white people accent. New Zealand is fine.
Oh, Kiwi.
German
okay.
is fine. Oh, okay. Swedish is fine. But if they are of a different ethnic coloring persuasion,
but Al,
if I may.
But Al, I'm a quarter Mexican.
Chinese, racist.
I'm a quarter Mexican.
Racist.
I'm a quarter Mexican. I can do this.
Yeah, thanks, Mitt Romney. Of course you are.
I am. I am as Mexican as Mitt Romney. I'm that kind of Mexican. So I'm a German Mexican.
In the white colonies, when our people were down there oppressing the locals.
Here's the thing, though. I love it when I remember a couple conferences ago, a 70s spoke whose name was like Guy Johnson or something like that. Dude gets up there and he talks with a little bit of an accent while he's talking, but he's a total white guy. And then I looked him up and it was because he actually is born and raised and still lives in the colonies. Yeah. And so even though those people are often, like my grandmother, Americanized, they don't speak English with an accent, yet that's a guy who does. And I remember they saw Mitt Romney's cousin during the campaign a couple years ago. And
Jose.
his name was Juan. Juan.
That reminds me, I hired a guy one time, or I was interviewing a guy, and his name was Xavier. Because he's black, it was obviously Xavier.
And
I read it.
That's racist.
Javier.
And you read it what?
I read it Javier. Definitely not a Javier. And I was like, hey, so what's up, Javier? And he's like, it's Xavier. I'm black. And I was like, oh, I did not
realize. Did he say that straight up too? It's Xavier.
Yeah.
I'm black.
He's a funny guy. But I was like, for some reason, like as I was reading that, I was like, I should have picked up on that. I'm really sorry. I know there's not any black Javiers out there.
Well, and if it's written with an X, it's often Xavier or Xavier. Javier can be.
I don't think you ever say X Xavier. You just say Xavier.
Well, some are Xavier and some are actually pronounced Xavier. It depends.
Who is what? What? Like the university Xavier is pronounced Xavier, not X Xavier.
That's the university. What about the leader of the X-Men, Charles Xavier? What about him?
Charles Javier, you mean?
Well, yeah, he is also a quarter Mexicano, man. I am offending so many.
This is a terrible show. We've got to erase all
of this. I look at our analytics, and this is going to shock you, but English is our number one speaking download language. So we do not
–
we have more like Portuguese speakers than native Spanish speakers listening in. So whatever. I love the Hispanic community so much.
I don't think that makes it okay.
This show is going to...
You can't make fun of their accent and then say, I love those
This
people.
Show is going to ruin my chance to run for office in any state that's close to Mexico at some point later
wouldn't
on.
Wouldn't you love like running for president someday? And they're like, Jeff, do you recognize this clip from episode 422? Hey, everybody.
And I'll be like,
was that or was that not your voice?
I'll say, this is why I was the people's representative from North Dakota. They elected me.
then you turn around to all cool your supporters. You say, shut it down. It's over. Shut it down.
Shut it down. Well,
we're not going to win this thing. They found our TWIM archives.
But you know what? We only post the most recent 100 episodes most of the time. So if we keep going for many more years, this will eventually fall off the ledge, so to speak. And this show won't
go away.
The show won't really
we're gonna be fine.
Exist.
We're gonna be fine
anymore. We're gonna have a great time. We're gonna have a great time. How are you, friend?
It's gonna be good. I'm well. I'm well. I've been busy. We are doing this show on a Sunday night, not our normal because
rare.
We are both busy men this week.
Do you remember that originally when we did the show for a long time, Sunday was our we always had like a fixed time. It was like Sunday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific or something.
Then we wanted to have like our Sunday relax, worship Jesus day instead of our make jokes day.
Yeah. Well, this
so
is,
we moved it to Monday night and it was our family home evening. Now you're married with a family and I am alone in my family home evening with nobody.
Al, that's because I chose to get married. As many of you who are single should remember when listening, your singledom is a choice. quit choosing to be single.
Such a donkey.
I can find remarks from Elder Ballard in this recent
conference.
It took
you 31 years to choose to be single.
Look at me right now. Look into the webcam. I want to have a one-on-one interview.
This is why once you're married, you can't be friends with married people anymore. If you can only be friends with the same social class / like marital status as you are. Because your married friends will always, like, the second you get engaged, you turn to your friends and you say, guys, just keep your chin up. It'll happen for you. And you're like, you're a moron. It took you, like, we cried together Valentine's Day. We watched Pride and Prejudice alone together on that love sack, and I was there, and you remember that. And then you're like, nope, keep your chin up, guys. It's going to be fine. You just got to have faith.
I did once watch Notting Hill by myself on Valentine's Day.
No, and you live tweeted it, and you watched Air Bud.
Airborne, not Air Bud. Airborne's a very different film, a classic. Air Bud's about a dog, a golden retriever, that plays basketball. Airborne is about a surfer come inline rollerblader who has to move to Cincinnati and how he shows those wacky Midwestern folk the ways of the coast and how foolish they all are. It's a touching picture.
He's a blader.
Well, he's styling. As he says.
I feel like blading is slowly making a comeback, too, which makes me nervous because old people everywhere have a skilled advantage.
It never went away.
And like, dads are going to be like, check this out, kids. It's going to happen. Great form of exercise. Watch out.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you are keeping busy, keeping happy.
Yeah. We got some good trips coming up. Getting very excited. I got that cool.
Don't forget your passport.
I'm coming out to DC Award. I got to come and shake hands with Jeff Openshaw soon. So that's the award.
That's the award. It's the Jeff Openshaw Foundation annual award for douchery.
We should start issuing TWIM awards and start giving like the Mormon of the Year, the Times and Season does, completely made up and baseless so far as data goes. We should just start doing stuff like that and being like, you want a TWIMmy.
We could do the Twimmies. I mean, we could do it like the Razzies, though. Should it be best or should it be worst? You know what I'm saying? Like, what do we award, for the best or for the worst? That's the question.
I don't think you can award for the worst of the Mormons.
I think we can because then we'll just stack the field with Peggy and McKay, and they'll win everything. Every award.
McKay Coppins sweeps the Twimmies.
Well, with a little bit of Kevin Barney, and then to mix in, we'll do a little of the guy who does Air Helm the Times, who sent us the cease and desist letter. Beckstrom should actually be the one who wins the Lifetime Achievement Award.
Every year. And we'll just have the movie of him looking into the camera and then red eyes coming out.
Yeah, good so ideas. We love people. We love everyone. We're full of love.
No, we really should do a Twimmies Award and have it be an actual event. I would spring for the Super 8 banquet room.
And if you
invite people out?
No, yeah. The problem is we'd have to spring them to come there because no one's going to spend money to go to the Super 8.
No, they have to come there, and then in Liberty, but that's Missouri. That's the joke. They're all invited. We rent the room, have the dinner catered, and no one comes, and we just have like
and you and I present an award show to an empty room.
It's like the Dundies, but. But that would be so
great.
We
should
then
do it in a Chili's.
One sweet primary girl that comes up and receives all the awards on behalf of everybody else. Except for the one that's like an ordained women activist will show up and like sort of like the Emmys where they had like that Native American woman get up and accept on behalf of...
That was when Marlon Brando won an Oscar in the 70s.
Yeah, Marlon Brando. Yeah. So that style of thing before 70s. Ordained women, I could see that happening. An impassioned speech in support of it. And we're like, whoa, when did this become a political thing? This is just supposed to be for jokes.
And then we end it by saying, you are the weakest link. And you're gone. This could be delightful. Though, regardless of the event, considering the Mormon blogosphere... They do awards. There's Mormon of the Year. There's that one this year where we won a couple of awards for like best podcast or best news.
Wait, what did we win? When was that?
It was over at Wheat and Tares. We won two awards. One of them was the best like in the moment news. Apparently, we're the best place to go to really know what's going on right away.
We're Twitterers.
And we were good.
Were we supposed to fly somewhere and accept this? Was that in New Mexico? Let's go.
Alas, it was not. It was on Prince Edward Island. For Anne of Green Gables.
Hey, Too soon, man. Gil died.
I know. That's why it just popped in my head. Though that Gil died. I think we will do.
Did you ever watch that as a kid? You didn't.
Oh yeah.
You were totally older than your sister. I don't think you were would have been forced into.
No,
that.
I've got an older sister, so you know I remember seeing that stuff. Yeah.
Whew. I was always Team Gil.
It was on the Disney Channel all the time too. So I that's where my memories of.
Oh, sorry, I wasn't rich like some of us, Jeff. I actually had to work for a childhood.
Yeah, well, I lived in the suburbs of California where we had electricity and running water, amongst
which,
other luxuries.
Both of those things are things I did not have for extended periods of time as a youth.
I know what it was like growing up. You were like Moe's on The Office. That's what it was like growing
I'm
up.
I'm not even kidding. I had a bucket in the woods that we pooped in, and that is no joke. Boiled water, seven kids at home. No, there were six kids at home at the time. Boiled water, Little House on the Prairie style. I took my bath fifth, and the water is lukewarm at best by mm-hmm. fifth.
That's
not the greatest time.
So
but it made me who I am today. Little poop in the bucket in the winter, that sure spurs you to go be successful in business, I tell you that.
Thank you. Tips on defecation from Aldone. You should bring
those
up when you're
in DC. What
was
your week like, Jeff? What did you do this week?
It was good. Actually, this weekend on Saturday, I went to Busch Gardens Williamsburg. Very excited.
Is your wife is away visiting? Yes.
By the time this is basically published, she will be back with me. Yes, she went to California.
Went to Busch Gardens alone?
No. So she went to California for her baby shower. I revealed last week that we're expecting a child. It's very exciting. Al is going to be an uncle. We're all so pumped. Great times all around. So she went home
for
that.
His father will be so proud.
But then this coincided brilliantly with some other friends of mine posted that they're doing their, like, I've got some friends here who, like, they buy annual passes, and they go to Busch Gardens, like, 10 times.
Isn't Busch Gardens, like, a beer garden?
No. It is next to an Anheuser-Busch facility, but its history is different from that. It's an amusement park, you know. It's like Cedar Point.
Oh.
Nicer in some ways.
Like Cedar Point? It's that good?
I'll tell you. It's I'd say it's more atmosphere-wise, it's cooler than Cedar Point, because Cedar Point's a little more straightforward. It's just a theme park. Cedar Point has more and better roller coasters overall, but there are some good ones at Busch. So anyway, some friends who like go all the time organized a kickoff thing, invited people on Facebook, and I saw when they were doing it and said, dude, my wife doesn't even like roller coasters. This is the weekend she's gone anyway, so I wouldn't feel bad for ditching her on some other Saturday just to
Where's
go do
Busch
this.
Gardens located?
It's in Williamsburg, Virginia.
Oh, that's near you, yes.
No,
it's like an hour away.
2.5 hours away, actually. So it's a decent...
Yeah, that's right next to you.
It's a decent haul. It's closer down to, you know, Newport News down there. So we rode down there, and that was a very exciting day. Rode the coasters, lived the dream, had some fun.
Were your friends nice to you?
Were my friends nice to me?
Did they include you, buddy?
They did. I felt like I was dropping into, like, all these traditions I was unaware of. Like, they leave very early. They stop at a Waffle House in Mechanicsville, Virginia on the way.
I like these people.
All these very serious things. I was the weird, like, married guy who was there with San's spouse. Because the only other people there, the ones who were part of it, or in my ward, they were married. Everyone else was single. And a lot of them I didn't know. They're all from, like, the mid-singles ward.
Trying to pick up on you?
No, a lot of them, frankly, I didn't care to know, because I said, like, guys, let's really talk about opportunity cost here. The opportunity cost of establishing a relationship with you is much too high for actually trying to maintain the friendship, which isn't going to exist after this day. So for the smaller group of us that are kind of running around, I met a couple of you, I'm down. But when bigger groups would meet up for lunch and stuff, I'm just like, I don't care if I know who this woman is, because let's face it, I'm never going to see her again after today. I mean,
that's a great attitude. See, that's what Christianity is all about.
Right? But this is not Christianity. This is the Thunderdome, known as Busch Gardens. Okay? So it's different.
This isn't church. This is the Marriott Center.
It's martial law there. So that was fun. Very long day given the time.
Wait, so give me the best roller coaster they had. What are we
My favorite
about?
Roller coaster was Alpengeist.
I'm sorry, Alpengeist?
Is
that a Harry Potter theme?
It's called Alpengeist. It's in the themes in Busch Gardens, Virginia, are themed after countries in Europe. And so in the German Bavarian section, it's themed after like the Alps. Alpengeist just means ghost of the Alps or whatever. Alpine ghost, basically. It is do you remember Raptor at Cedar Point, the inverted one where the track was above us, feet dangling?
Yes.
It's like one of those, but it's a very, very good one. It's one of the best ones. Very, very fun.
Oh, well, that's nice. That's
so
really great.
That was probably my favorite of all of them. There were some other great rides, but that was very fun. And on more spiritual notes, I went to Steak Temple Night this week, which you, typically schedule-wise, I'm not able to go to the Steak Temple Night. I just go at a different time. But I went this week, and I got to go to a meeting up in the 7th floor priesthood solemn assembly room they have in the D.C. Temple.
Ooh.
Most of you who know a lot of, you know, church history, there's a handful of temples that have these large assembly halls on the top floor. There's only a, you know, there's a grip of them, and that's it. And I'd never been able to go up there. We've had meetings there before. And that was pretty fun. That was a cool. I wish my wife could have actually been with me for that. That was pretty cool to be able to go up there and have your stake president speak like it's a little stake conference with the stake members there, but talking about temple ordinances and stuff. And it was a cool experience. It was very neat. I was glad I was able to attend that. It was dope.
It would be fun.
It was dope. So I've had a fine and dandy time. And then I was so tired from Busch Gardens today, I took like a really longer nap than I should have. See. See, what happened was we got home really late, and then I called my wife.
You have no wife there. Of course you're going to nap for a long time.
And then I hadn't talked to my wife, actually talked to my wife for a few days. So she had her shower yesterday, so we talked on the phone. So I went to bed around 2 a.m. Eastern. Now, normally I have ward council at 6:30 in the morning. Thankfully, they canceled it, but I still had 8 a.m. church. So I was riding on about 5 hours of sleep. It was very tired in here. And so then I came home to take a wee nap.
It's tired in here.
I took a wee nap, or probably around 11:45, and I woke up at like 3:15, and I said, well, there goes the day. Happy Sunday.
It's like, oh, Jeff. Oh, Jeff.
That's what President Kimball said not to do when it came to resting on the Sabbath. He said, don't take long naps.
I say when you get a shot at resting on the Sabbath, go for it. You know, get what you can. You can do a little reading here and there. I'm reading a fabulous book right now. It's called. I don't know if I can recommend this. If you like reading in space, you'll love it. But there's several F-bombs in there. How do you feel about reading bad language, Jeff?
How do I feel about reading where?
Well, because for me, honestly, it's worse for me to hear it spoken.
Oh, with bad language. It is. Okay.
Yeah.
It's interesting. We've talked much about sort of whether, I don't want to say personal censorship, media standards. We've talked about that a lot on the show.
Sure.
For me, it goes in levels. It sticks with me more, it sticks with me most when I see it in a movie, for me personally. If I see characters swearing, that sticks with me more than if I hear it in music or to someone talking, and then lowest is if I read it. That doesn't mean it's okay necessarily.
Yeah, probably not okay.
But reading it affects me less than other delivery options.
The Martian is about this guy who goes to Mars with this team, and then he gets left there. And so its first line is like, I'm hosed.
Ah.
I'm like, oh boy, all right, hope this is. But you know what I mean? There's a little bit of like frustration.
Well, what I hate is sometimes I've read some books or even watched films, and most of it's pretty fine, and you hit like this one chapter when you're like, where did all these F-bombs come from?
My favorite is when you borrow it from your some high priest in the ward or something, and they've got it all blacked out. All right, I'm figuring out what's under that black marker. You're not fooling anybody.
I've totally been there. Sometimes that disappoints me because I'll feel like you've established a pretty good work here without the language. So why did you throw it
out? Yeah, no, absolutely.
Or another point, you might read it early in the book and say, okay, maybe that's a bit of a fluke. I'm just going to ride it out.
And
it never gets better. And then you read the whole book and say, I really had hopes. When I read, my wife and I have talked about this one. When I read Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential, famous book. It's kind of what put him in the spotlight. This memoir of being a chef and sort of the, let's face it, the seedy underbelly of the chef community. By about chapter two.
What happened in there? Is it like, what is the seedy underbelly of this?
For the sake of our audience, I'm not going to get into many details of it, but let's say.
Is there scandal?
There's scandal. There's language. There is much
lascivious. Chefs hooking up with chefs?
There is
murder?
Lasciviousness. There are things. And you'll read parts and be like, well, that's nice. Hopefully it stays okay. And then it just doesn't. And you say to yourself, why did I do this?
Yeah, I'm always torn on some of that. Well, because if it was in a movie, I'd be like, whoa, no thanks.
But it goes in waves. Like for my job, I mean, I'm exposed to like rough stuff sometimes. And I don't like it. But in some ways it can, I don't know if it desensitizes you. But like, you know, I'll watch stuff about what's going on in war areas. because American news censors a lot of stuff, a lot. But if you look at international outlets and find stuff, no, you'll find graphic images of people blown up and maimed in battle and plenty of uncensored language and stuff like that. But for the nature of my work, sometimes that's just, you know, it kind of runs with it. And I try not to let it desensitize me to the point where that stuff doesn't bug me, because it always will, and I'm glad, but what can you do?
Well, probably a good idea to choose not to consume that stuff when the option's there. It's really hard when it's a great work of fiction or something like that, or like you really appreciate the sort of effort that went into writing a great, compelling novel. You're like,
I've read the original edits of Harry Potter. It was filthy, let me tell
you. Was it really?
No. Come on.
Oh my gosh. It's like, and then Hermione and Ron.
Harry Potter was like the opposite. When in the seventh book, when Ron's mom starts, I love saying how geeky I am, but when she starts attacking Bellatrix and she says, "Not my daughter, you female dog." And that's like the only profanity in the entire series. That's like one when I read it and I was like, oh yeah, it's on. She's bringing the hammer.
Oh my gosh, you are such a nerd.
I am a nerd. This actually is an interesting segue into something I've been thinking about.
Yes.
Profanity.
Yes, go,
Jeff. Profanity at work. Right?
Go on.
What is the, I've been pondering this, because at my new job, there are many people there whom I love and I enjoy them all quite a bit, but I will say that language is not something that is heavily self-regulated in my office. I will admit it bothers me, but I'm not going to complain about it publicly, but I'm not going to complain about it to anybody there, and nobody in my office listens to the show. So there we go. But I deal with it. So I actually started keeping track of like the number of F-bombs I hear on a given day. I started marking it, because I was wondering myself, like, how much am I actually hearing on an average day as far as the profanity? And I guess I wonder, like, what is expected and normal, especially for Mormons, or what is unprofessional and
I do is I mutter under my breath, but audibly enough that they can hear the translation, and sort of rephrase their sentence for them so I don't remember it, right? Like, sexual intercourse me. Sexual intercourse me.
Don't quite say
that. Oh, poop. Poop, 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 poop.
Do you say that to yourself, or you say that out loud to try to teach them?
I say it out loud. I say it loud enough for them to hear.
Now here's the thing, though. You're the boss, so you could even straight up
tell. Well, no, I this has always been sort of my jam, and I'll call people out on it. You know, if they're getting a little rough, I'm like, hey, dude, that's crossing the line for me, like. Maybe you could cool it with some of the language. And I've actually never had any drama from that, because I'm pretty good natured about it, you know, like,
yeah, sure, like, sure.
In, you know, as the punctuation mark in a good story or something, like, I'm not gonna cry foul. But when there's a guy that's, you know, regaling his escapades of the weekend and it's all full for no reason,
it's like
Yeah, no, I'm totally fine to call him and be like, hey, man, that's a little heavy on the language. You mind
and
just
so,
easing up a little bit?
And so in my position, it's been curious to me, because I want to be like, hey, you know, stand up for what my standards are, and that's fine. And I can tune it out sometimes. Sometimes I just put my headphones on and just try to not worry about it.
Sometimes it's hard to be a peculiar people, Jeff. Sometimes you want to be a normal people.
And also, I'm a newer employee there. I can tell I'm well-liked and I'm doing good work and I've got good relationships with folks, but I haven't been there very long, and I also wouldn't
I would do
be...
the muttering and translation thing.
Yeah, and so I don't want to, like, rock the boat, you know, and be like the new guy who's here causing problems. That's another thing.
No, just be the guy that mutters to himself whenever you swear and repeats it as a not swear word.
I can't imagine what I would say sitting there at my desk when I hear something, and I'd just be like, yeah, frig that, frig frig friggerty.
No,
friggerty.
You trans to sex, to have sex, intercourse, be obnoxiously translated, because
I'm the guy at work discussing intercourse. How is that any better from a human resources standpoint when I'm openly I'm the guy who's just saying, like, sex, sex, sex.
I think the key is that sometimes we're a little bit sensitive to some of that stuff, but if somebody brought in, really anything that's offensive to us, if it's offensive to us, part of it is like, you know, if you told the guy that it was offending you, you'd be like, oh my gosh, you know, if I knew that it was actually, like, that wasn't something you did, I would try to be a little bit more accommodating to it.
Totally. And when we hear all these great stories, you know, when people stand up for their beliefs and people accommodate it, and I'm all for that. I think sometimes it's a little bit more difficult when you're still navigating the
waters. Yeah, don't be
waters.
Dramatic about it, but like all right, guys, we're getting a little heavy with the language. Let's ease it up a little bit. We're at work. You know, something like that doesn't, it's not offensive at all, but it.
And because in some ways, it's not just my Mormon beliefs, I feel like using a lot of profanity in the office is just unprofessional at the same time. Like, I don't see why there's cause for it. And mine's a little bit different. I do have a lot of former military people I work with, and while it's a cliche, yeah, language is something that comes a little bit easier to them than a lot of other folks. So there's that to be aware of.
It also helps that I'm like big, loud, and obnoxious, and I sort of, one of the ways that I like, then I make it easier for me to sort of keep my standards high is by obnoxiously letting people know about them. Not that I'm expecting them to do anything, but like, when somebody offers me a Mountain Dew, I don't politely decline. I say, I don't drink caffeine. Which used to be a lot more Mormon centric than now. They've took that out from under me, where now that's not as much a thing. You want to go out drinking? It's not. No, I don't drink. It's no, I don't drink. I'm Mormon. You know, I sort of use it as an opportunity to segue, and not to talk about it a bunch, but just, you know, I'm sort of okay with that being that. And then for me, like, I'm never tempted to drink because I know everybody's looking at me saying, I wonder what the Mormon's going to do.
Oh, I'm not tempted to drink just because I have a testimony, but I'm glad that yours is because you're trying to live up to expectations.
It helps, man. It helps.
Kidding. Yeah, that's, and the funny thing is, I talk about this little issue, but I've also had some of the more frankly open discussions about like just being Mormon at like this job than I have anywhere else. So it's kind of funny on the flip side of that, where you talk to people and they're very openly curious, like, what do you like? Honestly, I had a frank discussion with my coworkers about how we keep the law of chastity, and that entails no hanky-panky until you're married, which was a concept that blew my coworkers' minds. But they're like seriously? Because they're talking about weddings being a big deal. And they're like, so your wedding is like a big deal then? Because this is like a sort of rite of passage stuff. I'm like, oh, yes, yes, and everyone knows it. And it's a classic Mormon thing where like your guy friends are looking at you doing the old like chest bump, like you get it, Tiger. Make the magic happen. But it's kind of funny.
That would never happen.
And we talked about this because it's Mormon related, and that's what happens. But I'd love to hear anybody else's thoughts. I mean, I don't know, because a lot of people in Utah who might work, I'm not saying obviously not all Mormons, even Mormons profane, obviously. But, you know, I'm sure when we're in more of a majority environment, you might have an easier time not having people who use certain language. But
well, that's fair. So, like something in I don't Utah, love. I feel like, well, not just Utah, but like in Mormon-centric areas, I feel like sometimes people go out of their way to sort of break the mold to show that they're not sheep, and
it gets
kind of goofy, right? Where you're like, all right, man, I know you go to church on Sunday. Like, what are you doing? And yeah, I don't know.
That's true. So it's an it's an interesting exercise I'm learning in, like, trying to be obvious about how I represent myself, but at the same time, not trying to be like the nuisance guy in the office who is, you know, like, clamping down on what everyone does because of my belief system. So it's been a learning curve, I think. A good one, though. Good opportunity to learn how to share things. So I'm down with it.
Well, it's been good. I dig it.
Well, I mean, these
we
are
got a few Mormon things, Jeff.
There's yeah, I mean, there we go. There are news items, too, aside from our usual pondering of the things of faith. By the way, Al, I just have to share this with our people because I think you'll appreciate this. This is you, I'm sharing something you told me. In confidence. No, not really.
Go on.
So you're having a state conference here in a few weeks, and you got your stake to hold the state conference outdoors.
Well, it wasn't me alone. But
not you alone. The spirit was also
there.
But it
was sort of me and the stake president against everybody else. But our thing, so I'm actually really excited about this. We're holding it in an amphitheater. 2,500 people or so will be in attendance because it's a big stake. And so we haven't been able to meet together for a long time. And so the topic came up, and it's like, should we do it outside? And it went around for the vote, and everybody's like, no, there's, you know, my kids will be running around everywhere. What if the weather, you know,
the
like
weather
all of a sudden,
issue.
You know, it's not going to be coordinated seating, and it's going to be all kinds of drama, and we're not going to be paying attention. We're going to be looking at the butterflies and paying attention to everything else. And I'm like, guys, listen. Look back at your last five state conferences, and what do you remember from those? And they're like, well, and I was like, nothing. You try. I mean, there's some things you might have a quote or two, but like, you didn't remember that moment almost at all, no matter what you do. And so instead, like, you meet outside in an amphitheater in like the old days. I'm like, dude, you're gonna remember that. You may not remember much else, but you're gonna remember that you were there and the State Conference 2015.
You know what's also one of the best things about that? You're in an amphitheater, what? And so I imagine the priesthood will not be tasked with bringing chairs and setting them up and tearing them down, because those seats will be there already. That alone.
No, it's just a sloping hill. They are definitely tasked. 7 a.m., they'll be setting up chairs.
Well, then this is pointless then. I can't support this. I'm sorry.
But they're only doing chairs for like the handicapped people or people that need them. And then everybody else, they just say bring blankets or your own lawn chairs.
Don't the handicapped people already have their own chairs? Isn't that why we have handicapped seating? Because they have their chairs?
Oh, boy. All right. You are full of offensive comments today, Jeff.
I'm genuinely
asking. Why don't you say that in a bad Mexican accent, you jerk?
I can do all. Don't actually. You want me to do here? No, here. Let's do the accent. Let's talk like Alice Swedish forebears.
No, all right, we're done. So I'm excited about that. Also, I emailed my one of the guys on our stake presidency about the article that Jeff and I wrote about the Elders Quorum
or
the
priesthood,
the priesthood hour being the worst hour in church. And they were actually really excited about it. It was really well received. So I show up for meetings today, and they've got it printed out, and it was all like, "Thanks, Brother Doan, for this thing." And I was like, "Whoa, all right." I feel like I should have kept my mouth shut a little more and not jumped right into the fray here, because now I'm leading the discussion on Sunday for our training on. And I'm like, yeah, well, and I kind of feel like all the other guys on the council are like throw me under the bus. They're like, yeah. All right, hotshot. You got so many good ideas.
Exactly.
Why don't you train these people?
Like, have fun, son. We're just going to kick back. And
way to go after it, boy. While the rest of us pros sit here and don't have to do a darn thing.
That's pretty strong. I like what you're doing.
I was entertained. Yeah, but if you haven't read it yet, go read that article. It's a great article.
Yeah, just look for priesthood, worst hour, something like
that. Yeah, why is priesthood the worst hour of the week? And it's true, man. Like, I was in my high priest group this week. It's just a lesson straight out of the book, just doing our thing. And
I actually thought of your article when we had Elders Quorum, because it's like, all right, so if we could read this part, but the difference is our teacher does do some reading, but it's not because he's not prepared. It's because he wants to read specific sections that illustrate a point he's trying to get at. So it's a little okay, but when you start off with like, okay, so we got some parts to read, and I was like, oh no,
I'm a passionate fan of cutting that down to like a 20-minute lesson out of the book, because then even if you read the whole thing, it's still not the end of the world, because you have a few other sections where you can pull things together. But anyway,
I want to try to work in the musical numbers. That's what I'm going to try to work on.
You know what I did too is that there's other guys in our community that play music, and I was going to use that as a time to like invite them in.
Exactly.
To church, come play a musical number. It'd be great.
Exactly.
You don't have to be more.
Well,
into that.
Let's tack on a few some stories here in the news, folks. There were six. Did you know this last week was the anniversary of the Titanic sinking? This happens. As a matter of fact, every year it's the anniversary of the Titanic sinking in April.
And I feel like this happened just 1 year ago. Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. LDS Living published a report that talked about how six missionaries missed their voyage on the Titanic. They were slated to go on it, a bunch of them. But then I think one of them was held back and wasn't supposed to be able to make it on the Titanic boat. And they were excited. The Titanic was a very big deal when it was built. And so part of this is like, we're going to go back. They served missions in England. And they were like, we're going to go to Southampton. We're going to go home. And we're going to be on the Titanic. This is a big deal. But because this one missionary couldn't do it that day, the missionary kind of rallied everyone to do it all, said, you know what, let's stay back and take a boat the next day so that we can all go home together. And because of that, they were not on the Titanic when it sank. And so these other elders later on wrote about it and said, like, look, elder, you who were stuck here saved our lives. Like, thank you so much for being stuck in your area and not being able to go home the day before, because we are all still here because of it. So it's a minor little thing
there
here.
There were other
living.
Faithful Mormon people who did die on that, yes?
There were. Which happens, unfortunately. It, This is unrelated to Titanic, but it actually only dawned on me when I had a meeting with my member of my stake presidency the other week. Like, I had not even processed that in my stake people died in 9/11. You know, like, we don't think about these things. Like, we just forget them. Cause, I wasn't living here then. But, I mean, yeah, it makes sense. I mean, the Pentagon borders my stake. Plenty of people I know here work in the Pentagon. And people in my stake died during 9/11 when the plane crashed in the Pentagon. So, obviously,
doesn't that always make you feel a little bit weird? Like talking bit, about yeah. sort of the miraculous saving of those six. You know, you want to – you're excited for that because they were spared. But then what does that say to the widow of the guy that, you know, was excited to go on that Titanic and go see his wife and baby?
Yeah. I mean, I think the only way to look at this is, hey, this was a tragedy when people of all walks of life and beliefs.
Let's celebrate
and
that these
died.
Six lived.
But we can celebrate that six lived. And it's an interesting story because it was six missionaries who missed it for a particular reason. And
for the one guy that wouldn't wake up on time.
Basically, the one guy who's like
the apostate
nope.
missionary was really the one that was in tune.
He was like, guys, it's preparation day. I'm not going anywhere. Save this for attracting day so I don't have to, you know, waste my day of shopping.
Come He's on. Like, what, we're going all the way to America? No, I'll do that after I'm done emailing my girlfriend.
And then he also said, I've heard that when you're on the Titanic, you get stuck down in the belly of the ship with all the Irish people, and all they do is dance and drink, and Jack and Rose are there dancing.
It's like a William Shatner song. All right, so the other one, let's see. A few articles this week. The one that I really liked was third century, like what challenges the church will face as it moves into the third century. It turns 200 years old.
Oh.
About. What?
Yeah. This is a good one. This is by Peggy.
Yeah, P. Fletch.
P. Fletch.
But it turns 200 years old here in a couple of years, 15 years or so. And so what challenges will it face going into its third century?
Sherry Dew will be the challenge.
That's fair. Well, because the church up to this point has, it's faced its share of challenges, but largely society has sort of structured the challenges that it's had to face, right? It's as society has evolved, the church has had to sort of respond to that, where in the beginning days of the church was sort of the forward-thinking socially, and the society was catching up with it. Well, now it's sort of this neck-and-neck operation, but there's a couple of specific things that Peggy Fletcher Stack pulls out and says, hey, this could be... No, she's not. It's not even her. It's some
she
dude,
pulls from a
mouse,
number. She pulls from a Moss. She pulls from a he's
who's that
mouse,
guy? What's his name?
Armin Moss. Mouse. He's written a bunch of things. Armin Moss. She pulls from a number of different authors, though. A number of authors, not just him, but for different.
He says one of the conundrums is the or one of the problems is correlation. And I actually had to ask Jeff what are we talking about when we talk about the correlation conundrum? And would you mind explaining that again, Jeff, just in case everybody isn't on the same page here?
I would love to. Correlation took place in the late 50s, early 60s during the McKay era. It was the question of how to manage more effectively the growth of the church, particularly the international growth. Basically, the messaging was not consistent. Auxiliaries sort of ran autonomously up to this point. And many, especially those who sort of want more right things for women in the church, looked at this as a breaking point because back up to that point, the Relief Society was largely autonomous and did whatever they wanted. So under correlation, things were brought under the direction of the priesthood. Manuals were standardized. All this was very important for an international church. Without it, it would have been very, very difficult for the church to expand beyond its Western American roots. I mean, honestly, it would have been.
So it's the idea that you have a single, the Sunday school manual is produced for the entire church, and it comes out once a year.
But,
and
not just that. Before that, they would make manuals, but the Sunday school committee sort of did their own thing, and they would make manuals that might have run at odds with what the Sunday school, with what the Relief Society manual might be.
All a three-ring binder operation? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, sort of, and that's why it wasn't just basically it was the fact that sure, one thing is they were autonomous, but also it was to give the 12 and the first presidency greater oversight, direct oversight on what all the auxiliaries did.
Oh, yeah, and they consolidated meetings into a single 3-hour block. And
all a lot of success. And a lot of it, like we said, definitely good stuff. But up until this day, there are many who struggle with some aspects of correlation because we feel like it takes away from the diversity within the church. It doesn't allow some of the auxiliaries to flourish. There are many who struggle with the fact that the Relief Society functions under the priesthood. That's a whole other topic. So that's a thing.
Definitely. Well, and as the church moves forward, right, continues to be a bigger thing as the church has to address head on sort of the cultural differences, right? So what does the church look like when it lands in Tahiti or when it lands in China? Does it account for any of the local culture and customs that are part of that people's traditions or worship or how they communicate? You know, and I know there's sort of a tendency in the church to be like, well, no, I mean, you leave those traditions and make new traditions. But like, there's legitimate, if I grow up in some other land, the way that I communicate or show respect or reverence, it may be completely different than the way that we do it in the Wasatch Valley. And so being able to accommodate some of that or accept people's sort of who people are, and help them as they draw closer to God and like apply the church as an overlay to the great things that are already in that culture, I think has to happen.
But then we also get into very difficult discussions about like what defines reverence then. Is that a cultural thing, or is what we take to be Wasatch Western American definitions of propriety and decorum and stuff like that, is that actually that, or is that actually the way the Lord, is that how the Lord wants it to be, regardless of the culture where it is exported? And there's a fine line there between this American culture being exported and what is actually the gospel and what should go forth. And it doesn't matter what your tradition is in Japan or something like that. This is the tradition of the Lord. I think a lot of it is American exceptionalism rolled into that, and we are working on that.
I mean, if I'm a white guy from Utah and I land in Ghana and they're banging drums while, like for them, that might be a rhythmic thing that they do and like very worshipful and reverence inducing. And for me, I'm looking at it and I'm saying, this is awful. This is the worst. And being able to, now that we're sort of a more grown up church, I feel like there's room for us to go into each of these cultures and say, well, let's not just be, white Utah Americans coming in and telling you how to do this, but we have the tools at our disposal to sort of counsel with local people and structure the right fit for that. I would love to see something like that. And I would love to go to Africa and get still something that's familiar to me so far as the church goes, like a block that's sort of predictable and a bishop and the structure and all that's still there. But if they... if they have, a different style of music, they don't need our hymns from Salt Lake City in order for them to worship, right?
Maybe, but the question is, at what point do you relinquish control on those sorts of things? Because then we do pride ourselves in this notion of the church nominally being the same everywhere. So that's the idea that then, because we might go there and experience that, but what if, say, you used Ghana, what if the Ghanaian member then travels to the States and is discontented with the more solemn, bland form of worship they might see stateside? Are they to tell us that we're not the... You know what I'm saying? Like, they're searching for unity, though, amongst the saints. And I think that's the difficulty in establishing the cultural unity. And that's hard when we are an international body and we're going into places with completely different norms and mores. For sure. It's tough.
Yeah, that's really tough. I know the church has a committee on cultural adaptations or relations or something like that.
And thankfully, a lot of that stuff is even left at the local level. Like, it's not like Salt Lake dictates everything. You can have, stake presidents and stuff who say, you know what, this is something we do differently. Or just the area presidency in the 70s. And you mentioned Africa, and there are documented cases. We should have Russell Stevenson actually talk to us about this. He would know very well. Where the church has allowed some of the more... tribal or native traditions of forms of worship to not take place on Sundays, to not replace what is a traditional Mormon sacrament meeting, but to still engage in those things on some night during the week as a cultural expression of faith, so to speak. And we've dabbled in things like that more and more.
Yeah. I think we got to get better.
I think we will reach the ultimate pinnacle of having achieved being better at it when we stopped like doing handcart walks in Greece, you know, for Pioneer Day. Like,
yeah,
that's the one that kills me when I've seen footage of like Japanese members doing their handcart walk. And it's great to remember where we come from as Latter-day Saints, no matter where we're from.
Our Japanese pioneers did not do this.
Sometimes I feel like Pioneer Day is the most like forcefully exported churchy thing that we do abroad, and they just don't care. But it's different. You know, we could go on this for all day, because you go to Europe, active saints, like, don't care at all about gay marriage. And they look at what we do in the U.S. as this odd culture war, and they don't care. And they just kind of do their thing and mosey on, and they'll even view like obsession with white shirts. And
yeah,
anyway, it's all the question of what is actually the Lord's standard, regardless of where we live, and what is just
some of the other stuff he mentioned is trouble or the potential things that we'll be dealing with. Unconverted converts, essentially the missionaries' goals and the bishop's goals not necessarily being aligned so far as the pace of growth of the church goes, and you know, people not being fed adequately as they are brought in. Also, obviously, the female and the priesthood sort of understanding or balance that's there will be
Claudia Bushman mentions that and really says that it would be a rash thing, especially it's a thing some people hate to hear, but that like, would men stay as committed to the gospel if they didn't have these great extra responsibilities that we engage in, even if it's stuff like shoveling sidewalk, you know, very home teacher-esque things, helping people move, putting up chairs. There's nothing that can say women can't do that stuff, but so often it falls on the shoulders of the priesthood body, and there's a question of whether men would remain active in church if they like weren't given these responsibilities.
Well, there is an element of like men being, you know, being needed or having some sort of a responsibility that is fleeting in our society of everybody is the exact same. And so having some of that in our church culture, I know as a man is sometimes very, very nice to feel like, oh, well, I gotta go stand in the cold and shovel this because I'm in the elders quorum and I gotta do that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That was,
go ahead.
No, just go. I was just going to move on to some other ones.
Yeah. I was going to say the last one is doubting disciples, sort of creating a church where struggling through questions or not being certain is okay, especially in the age of the internet, and as people sort of work through their faith, having an open enough culture in the church while still maintaining a core doctrine that is helpful and educational, and leads people back to Christ. That's one of those that Jeff and I know we've both talked about extensively and are very conscious of. But you see great discourses from Elder Holland, from Elder Uchtdorf, people, you know, apostles that are saying, you know, we are a church. We're a church that's okay with you not being perfect and not understanding perfectly. And as long as you're okay with us not being perfect, let's all just work on being better together. And I like that shift. I feel like we're being very proactive there right now.
And then there is a final one here, individualism and internationalism. I think we've kind of touched on internationalism a little bit. Individualism is very interesting, though. Just they give an example of how a lot of Latino saints are falling away, especially, I think, in the U.S., because they feel like their needs are not really discussed. Like, we're not sensitive about that. Like, we expect them to show up to church, which is often sort of a WASPy endeavor for many of them. But, you know, they're worried about jobs and immigration reform and political questions of equality and discrimination. And these are things we don't really talk about in church. It's not really our deal. And so that was an interesting little bit of note. And the fact that we have a greater sense of individualism than we have had before. And
should we be discussing those things at church?
It's hard to say, because there are many who want to talk like more social justice type things from the pulpit. I've seen a slight shift, it seems like, to some of that in General Conference, but I don't think we're ever going to be like this big, you know, pounding the pulpit social justice body. We're more calculated in our approach, I think, than to just do stuff like that. But I do think it's important to bear in mind the particular needs of those who do not fit what might be, say, the majority socioeconomic norm within our congregations, because those are often the most vulnerable to spiritual decay and atrophy and not feeling involved, and then they're less inclined to come because their needs are different, and because they aren't the ones who want to just hang out and talk about, you know, how you're decorating your backyard and this and that. You know, they could have this whole ward, and I've seen this, where it's like those interests are not things that line up with their day-to-day struggles. Their day-to-day struggles are like finding furniture and transportation for their kids and having food and things that the rest of the ward might not really be concerned with.
Yeah, man.
Native.
It's going to be an interesting next century.
You're going to have a great time.
It's going to be – you're going to have a great time. Just get the ticket.
Some other quick ones here. See, we were trying to do a quick show this week, and look where we are. We're already at the 50-minute mark. We're crazy people. Crazy people. Jana Reese, whom I sometimes feel finds reasons to complain about things when she doesn't need to, but still, discusses the Miss Virginia winner that we talked about last week, Becca Pence, who touted her modesty as a driving force behind what she was
doing. Well, we did too. We gave her props for being modest in there. I think that's probably a difficult thing to do while everybody else is dressing to win.
Yep. And she said, you know, that's great. Now, the great line here I get from this, though, is that Jana Reese says, after quoting her on how great her modesty is, she just says, "This is not modesty. It's never inherently modest to parade a body in front of a consuming audience, making that body and its clothing a prime focus of our attention," which is a good point. So according to the pageant's website, 25% of the judging is based on how a woman looks in a swimsuit and another 25% on how she appears in an evening gown. And I think this is a fair point to make. And we've talked about concepts of modesty, I think, on the show before, that it's not just about how we dress. It's about not drawing undue attention to ourselves. And I think that's a fair thing to explore, though. Beauty pageants in and of themselves are, I think, quite natively immodest, because
there's a bit of John Oliver's last week tonight that comes into play
on Miss America. Yeah, that was a terrific segment. If you haven't seen that, I encourage people to watch it. That was a fascinating look into the Miss America stuff. So, but it's a good point. I mean, why do we have – it's great. We celebrate, yay, she's won this thing for being modest, but we're not taking the time to ask, like, should we even be celebrating someone winning something as objectifying and turn of the century as a beauty pageant?
Well, it is hard because, like, what about a cutest baby contest? Is that somehow immodest and vain, and we shouldn't participate?
In some ways.
What about, you know, like what about a talent show? Is that not being modest because you're flaunting? Or what about a sporting event where you're showing how great you are? I mean, there's an element of the modest argument that I think it sort of runs its course and just becomes silly.
Yeah, but you can be modest about your talents with sports. I think the main thing is a beauty pageant. Well, yes, one can work on one's beauty. I mean, your genes are one thing, but sure, you can work out, you can have style, you can do stuff to augment that, right?
It's not easy. I've seen Miss Congeniality.
But at the end of the day, one is being judged for one's physical appearance. When we are judging a talent show, someone has cultivated these talents. And it is funny when looks account for 50% of the judging. Just straight up, like, if you look good in a bathing suit, you're going to score more points here than the woman who doesn't look quite as good according to our arbitrary rules.
No, and you're right. There is some genetics. But I know some beauty pageant girls, and that is not an easy thing to keep up.
Well, no, it's not. It requires lots of visits to the doctor for various injections.
You're cutting out foods, you're dieting, you're working out. I mean, it doesn't just happen, right? You don't just.
I know, but Al, I feel like you're condoning behavior that leads us to this sort of false construct on what actual value and beauty
is.
Well,
I am a little bit just in the aspect that I'm not okay with sort of the, I guess like beauty pageant shaming straight out of saying, well, you know, you're not modest if you participate in those, because there's an element that makes it very, very similar to any other contest where you're saying, is this person better than this other person?
Yeah. Yeah. Because either way, if you're, I mean, I understand your argument.
And I think Jana Reese is just jealous.
She might be, because she does actually say, you know, like, drawing attention to oneself is never modest. And I guess in some ways that's true. In some ways, you can't help it. If you're a popular sporting figure and you're good at what you do, you're going to be famous for it.
Or if you're the best-looking girl in a swimsuit.
But look at it this way. Like, if you are a famous athlete or an actor or something like that, are you doing it because you like the fame and the glory and you like the attention, which
absolutely
is immodest? Or are you doing it because you like the work that you're doing? You do appreciate that it makes you successful and stable, and that's great. But you do it for those reasons. You know, because if we're doing we're doing it to seek the praise of the world.
No, when you perform in front of 50,000 people every week, it's that the adrenaline of being in front of those people and like feeding on that that keeps you coming back. And it's almost an addictive thing. Because, well, I've never performed in front of 50,000 people, but I've done like speaking engagements in front of tens of thousands of people. And there's a part of you that, like, when you get that, you want more. And you're not there because you really like talking a lot. You're there because people really like hearing what you have to say. And that's what feels good.
I don't know, Al. Let's look at Ronald Reagan. They drafted Reagan to run for president. He was so modest that he would not run for president. This happened.
All right. Anyway, so the last one, there's some new temple presidents. Nobody that we know. Nobody that we know. So for as far as we're concerned,
because they're very modest, they're not talking about it. They're very modest temple presidents.
Yeah. But speaking of modest, I mention that I'm going to the White House? Can we all just talk about that some more?
Yeah. Remember a couple of years ago when you won some other award and you were supposed to go to the White House and like nothing cool happened in the end? Remember?
Yeah. We could be way overplaying this. This could be a disaster.
Yeah. See, you're being immodest. Ha ha. Quick
There's
mention
the
here.
Turleys cool. are serving a mission for the Mountain Vista Ward in Mesa, Arizona. They're presidents
that's,
of a temple. The Silvas from the North Ward, 18th North in Salt Lake. The Paulsons. Okay. From the Holiday Ward, 70th, or Holiday 4th Ward, and the Lewises from Arvada, Colorado.
Colorado.
Oh, and the Harringtons from Safford, Arizona.
That's terrific.
Anyway, that's that.
Cool. Little thing to look at the Washington Post if you want to check it out. World's least religious countries. Just a graph to show where religion is bigger and where it is smaller.
Who's
Some non-shocking ones. Well, China is the least, but that's not a really shocker. But then you got countries like Sweden and the Czech Republic, where 3/4 of the population claim to be atheists or irreligious.
I noticed that when I was on Tinder in the Czech Republic, and everybody was like, why are you putting that you're LDS? And I was just like, aren't you?
So you find, like you might guess, a lot of Europeans. And of course, the U.S. bucks the trend. There's another graph from Pew that came out a while ago that's a crack up when it shows levels of development economically and religiosity. And everything follows this beautiful, clean curve, except for the U.S., which is like way religious and more developed than anybody. It's kind of funny. Anyway, everybody, please join us on social media at thisweekinmormons.com. Shoot us an email, contact at thisweekinmormons.com. Find us on Twitter. Find us on Instagram. Do all these things.
Leave I agree. Reviews. I'm on your side.
And go to thisweekinmormons.com. Al, thank you for joining us this week.
Jeff, what a delight. Talk to you later, buddy.
Later. Thanks for listening to Twim, folks. Hey, have a great week. We'll talk to y'all later. Bye-bye. If I lay face down on the ground, would you walk all over me? Have we learned what we set out to learn? Well then, love, we will see. Now don't drown in your tears, babe. Push your hair.